When you have insurance, it's easy to forget about your out-of-pocket costs. That can be a lot of money. How do you know you're not overpaying? HealthLock can help. HealthLock is a technology company that securely connects with your insurance and reviews your claims for overbilling, wrong codes, and even fraud. To date, HealthLock has saved its members over $130 million. To save, visit healthlock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast host Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hi, I'm Molly Jongfast, and this is Fast Politics, where we discuss the top political headlines with some of today's best minds. And President Zelensky says to Trump, if you can really stop the war in 24 hours, I invite you to Ukraine. We have such a great show for you today. Former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich joins us to talk about the impact of the child tax credit and other policies Biden can enact in a second term and also right now. Then we'll talk to Balls and Strikes editor Jay Willis about the Supreme Court's horrifying next move. But first we have, because it's a Monday, the host of the enemies list, the one, the only, the Lincoln Project's own, Rick Wilson. Welcome to Fast Politics, my buddy, Rick Wilson.
It is I.
It's been a fruitful week for you and also for the Lincoln Project more generally.
I would say so. We had an ad that now has something like 11 million views and 600,000 shares. And it's right now in beautiful New Hampshire on a truck outside of every Trump rally.
I wanted to talk about the truck.
Sure.
So the ad is playing on a truck.
Well, it's playing on TV also, but yes.
Right. That seems like the kind of thing that would make him crazy.
Well, here's the thing we did. I give full credit to Philip Germain and our team, who is the master of these truck things. He's our trolling director for the trucks. We've got two of them. One of them followed the Trump bus, where Elise Stefanik, the Gretchen Wieners of Republican politics, was. And one of them was in front, one was behind. Outside the rally space, you had to walk by the truck twice if you were in line to go to the Trump rally. We know that this kind of thing. And it, by the way, it's like de minimis expense, but is maximum trolling. We know their staffers have been coming out to the looks like, you're going to get sued by Mr. Trump. Okay, fuck off. Go away. We've been to this rodeo a few times. But the ad basically came out and it flipped this whole like Trump is God thing and on its head. And it's called, you know, God Made a Dictator. It's an inversion of their bullshit from last week, which Trump is telling evangelicals, I am God, or I am God's representative. I'm the avatar of the of all your religious desires. You know, we just weren't going to put up with it. It's been an ad that's been bigger than anything anybody's done this year. And frankly, bigger than anything we've done this year. We've had a few good ads this year or in the last 12 months. But this one was a really big smack into Trump's head. He's very unhappy about it because our little birds from his campaign sing to us again. And we know they're trying to keep him away from commenting on it, because every time Trump opens his mouth this week, he sounds
like a batshit
crazy lunatic, which is, you know, probably the advantage of being true.
I want to like pause for a second. Trump is going to be the nominee. And we in the chattering political pundit industrial complex have been saying this for about, oh, I don't know, 2.5 years.
Not all of us, but a lot of us. Yes, correct.
Yeah, because the reality is, if you offer nothing, which the other candidates did, Trump without the charisma and Christie, who never had a shot in hell, you know, it's like this saying, "You, if you come at the king, you best not miss." If you come at the king and don't even come at him, you miss.
Right. If you come at the king and don't make an argument why you should be the king, a real argument, not like a I'm nicer
or anything. Yeah.
And again, we've talked about this a lot. There's no diet Trump. Okay. There's no like light, less sugar, less caffeine, less fat Trump. They want the real thing. And so Ron DeSantis was always trying to be Trump without being Trump.
Well, he was Trump without the charisma.
Oh, yeah. Look, he was saying, I'll give you all the culture war shit you want without being a soon to be indicted felon. And that didn't work out either, because they don't care. They're post rule of law. They're post conservative. So all these people today who are like, Nikki Haley's taking the fight to Trump. I'm like, guys, you got 3 days till the New Hampshire primary.
She came in third in Iowa.
Right. The ballgame is already over. Stop insulting everyone's intelligence by pretending that this thing is going to last to Super Tuesday. DeSantis will be out by Tuesday night is my guess. I think
he's going to be out today, right?
He might be out today. Look, let me tell you, the first time Casey DeSantis has to fly coach on Delta, that campaign is over and done.
She backed down.
They backed down.
They backed down.
The backing down has been spectacular in the last week. They have gone through $150 million, modestly. That's a low boundary.
Of which Jeff Rowe got
67.
Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah, go on.
67 cents of every dollar that the DeSantis campaign spent, Jeff Rowe took in to his companies, whether it was to the DeSantis campaign or the super PAC, which was, as you know, not what we call traditionally legal.
Right.
It requires a novel interpretation of what we call the law. But OK, we'll play that out. We'll pretend that doesn't exist right now. All that happens in this space of a campaign that was, you know, doomed from the start. Everyone knew it, except apparently Ron and Casey. And people are shocked that it's failed. People are shocked that it didn't work. We've said it from the start. Every single thing about Trump and Trumpism is a cult. It depends on cult-like adulation and adoration. And no one should be fooled that the result was going to be anything but what it was. It's exhausting.
Let's have a minute of media on media violence.
I am always here for that.
We saw so many think pieces about Joe Biden's age.
Sure.
Over the last 2 days, Donald Trump has confused Obama with Biden more than once, and he has confused Nikki Haley with Nancy Pelosi. Two people who, while their names start with N, have almost nothing in common.
I'm starting to think Grandpa Mumblefarts out there on stage is not all together. I'm starting to think Donald Trump might be feeling a little wee touch of the old Alzheimer's, because this is a guy who, there used to be an era where serious reporters would say, oh, he said Covfefe, that's because he's a brilliant 5D thinker and it's three-dimensional chess and Trump's communicating secretly with his bait. No, he's a drooling old fool. He's a guy who's got a diaper valet now following him around because he's verbally and physically incontinent. Nothing about this is from strength. It's because he's just a gibbering fool. I wish the national media would spend 1 minute of the time that the New York Times has done, like, insiders say Biden's age continues to concern. And I don't see a headline, double truck front page, saying Trump's 17th bout of verbal dysentery this week, where he conflated, you know, the wrong people, the wrong facts. He thinks he beat President Obama. Really? What? And even the Republicans are pretending this isn't real now. They used to pretend, oh, he's playing some game, or that's Trump being Trump. Now right. They're saying like, oh, shit. You know, what the fuck?
I've sat through a million conversations with people. Biden looks too old. He walks like an old man. His, you know, this is that. You have a guy who's out there looking like he's going to die, confusing Nancy Pelosi with Nikki right. Haley.
And Barack Obama. I mean, with Joe Biden, and saying Jeb Bush started the Iraq war.
Right, Jeb.
You can criticize Jeb for any number of things in that campaign, but he didn't start right. the Iraq war.
The Iraq war. I mean, so that's what I don't totally get.
Oh, listen, I totally get it. It's explicable as hell, Molly. This guy is great for ratings. He's great fun. The craziness is a spectacle, and the idea that he's going to be such a nut on the trail is unbelievably appealing to a lot of people who will, they'll be mad at me for saying this, and they're mad.
Oh yeah, go for it. Then we like it even more.
But a lot of these folks had a great run with Trump. They got to write books. They got to do a lot of TV. They got to have fun. And look, people would say, oh, you did the same thing. I was trying to warn you fuckers off this guy. I was trying to scare you because he would lead to the destruction of America. And I guess I was wrong. I guess people, you know, wanted more of the chaos. And the more they want, the more they'll get.
I mean, no, I get you and I get what you're saying. But I also think it's surprising to me. Here we are. We all know, like, if Trump gets elected again, there will be no more mainstream media, right?
Right. When he says things like, I'm going to take away MSNBC's license, he's not fucking around. You don't think Steve Bannon, you people don't think Steve Bannon day one is going to say to the FEC, by the way, I want to remove all of NBC's broadcast licenses because they're libtard cucks. And they'll say, but Mr. Bannon, libtard cuckery is not a reason or an excuse. And he'll say, well, fuck you. The president's going to issue an executive order banning libtard cuck media.
Right.
How hard is this?
And by the way, I mean, what I think is the scariest is that the Heritage Foundation has a 2030 plan or whatever it's called for when Trump gets back in office.
Project 2025. This time it's personal.
Right. Project 2025. This time we really fuck you. I actually don't think that people want Trump back. I actually think it's this weird, perverse two sidesism and an overcompensation to look nonpartisan that drives a lot of mainstream media.
I think that's a lot of it. And look, the Republicans, I wrote about this a lot in my second book. The Republicans have played the refs on the media side for so long that the New York Times is now afraid to not have a pro-coup voice or whatever on the op-ed page. I mean, when you see that piece last week from Ross, it wasn't really a coup per se. They didn't call it one, so it wasn't. What? Wait, what?
Right.
The fuck?
I know. Well, and I mean, you know it was bad because The Atlantic was like, no, it was
right, right. Yeah, the Atlantic is more genteel than a lot of organizations. And when they say it's a coup, people.
Yeah. I mean, they were like, yeah, actually, it's kind of a coup. But the other thing about it is, like, a failed coup is still a coup.
Yes. A failed coup is a training exercise.
Right. Another thing that Trump enablers have done, which is what Adam Serwal in that very good piece. Yes. In The Atlantic said was that they've been killing themselves to sort of say it wasn't a coup because it didn't work. And then also this idea that the 14th Amendment was about Reconstruction, and Reconstruction is totally different than trying to have slates of fake electors change the result of an election.
The bright line lettering of the 14th Amendment, and I'm no constitutional attorney or an attorney of any kind, so don't take legal advice from me.
Nor
the
am I.
Idea that the bright line lettering of the words insurrection only referred to the Civil War is madness. It's madness.
Yeah, but it's also this phenomenon where people just continually change the rules for Trump.
Yes.
Right? Like, if you're under 35, you can't run for a president, right? If you're born in a different country, you can't run for president. If you are involved in an insurrection, you can't run for president, except if you're Trump, because it's different. Because his people will get upset.
And by the way, the same argument that they're making now of Trumpian exceptions to the Constitution and the rule of law, which they make that argument every day, they will make that argument for a third full term. Mark my words. They will come out and say, Well, he was treated badly. Look, he said this himself. They treated me so unfairly that I deserve another term. And if people don't think that's what's going to happen, if he's president again, or they'll just make it dynastic. Well, I now have reached the age where I'm going to pass along the presidency to my son, Prince Eric the Slow, you know?
Right. And I want to like talk about this for a minute, because one of the things Trump has been saying on the stump, when he's not confusing Nancy Pelosi with Nikki Haley or confusing Barack Obama with Joe Biden, because they seem so similar.
They all look the same to him.
Right, exactly. He does this other thing where he makes this whole argument about how presidents should have complete and utter immunity. Now, we know this is because he's facing 91 criminal counts. So how does an electorate get excited about that? Explain to me how this helps candidate Trump.
Candidate Trump is driven, or his people are driven, by this imaginary sense of oppression and this imaginary sense that there's an elite constantly out to get them. Look, the elite wants you to not fuck your first cousin and to brush your teeth, okay?
I don't even care about the first cousins. I'm fine with that.
I will say this. That world, though, for them is very coherent. And they see anytime that Trump is held to account for anything he's done, said, or desired, they see that as an attack on themselves. It is a superpower in politics right now. I take it seriously, which is why when people say, oh, Trump's just joking, he's just shit talking, it's just Trump being Trump, it's never just Trump being Trump. It's never just shit talking. This is a guy with a movement behind him. It is an authoritarian movement. We'll say it 1,000 more times before this election's over, but that authoritarian movement is dedicated to taking power at any cost and holding that power as long as they can. They are not small d democracy fans. They are not fans of liberty or freedom, except for Trump and his family and a limited clique of his supporters. This is a dangerous movement. And for all the fun that people seem to have with it, you know, look at the crazy thing you said today. The craziness is a very deep, scary element of our politics now, and people are wired in for it. People who don't take it seriously and don't take him seriously are the ones putting us at risk.
Yeah, and the Heritage Foundation is right there with them.
By the way, the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025, that's the gentry part of their plan. That's the country club part of their plan. That's the part of their plan they can take out to major donors and say, well, this is here, we're going to reform the way processing is done on applications in the Department of the Interior. When they mean, we're going to set up a system where our political opponents are systematically jailed and prosecuted. We're going to do the things that we claim are being done to Trump because we want to exercise political power in a way that is tyranny adjacent. And they will. Trump was incompetent in his first term because he didn't know what he had. And not even his most weird and passionate supporters like Steve Bannon understood what they had. And what they had was mishandled and put in the hands of a variety of people who were not so smart, you know, Jared Kushner, etc. That problem will not be there this time.
Right. I just want to pause for a second because we're out of time, but I just want to say one thing. During Trump's only term, the first 2 years he had the House, the Senate, the presidency, and they still had a government shutdown.
Yeah, of course. It's a feature, not a bug.
Which is incredible. Thank you, Rick Wilson.
Anytime. Bye.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. oracle.com/strategic.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rocked the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James. LeBron James.
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
Western nations like the U.S. and Europe.
Mexico will likely have its first female president.
And then you have China.
And help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters.
He'll get his yo-yos to Europe in time. But the longer this drags on, the more worry he's getting.
They knew that they needed to do this as fast as they possibly could to get a drug on the market as fast as they could.
I'm David Gura.
I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen. We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets.
Basically, everyone was expecting, if not a calamity, certainly a recession.
But the problem is that that paperwork, as our reporting showed, is fake.
As someone who's covering the market, I'm often very worried about an imminent collapse. So I'm thinking about it quite often.
Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Robert Reich is former Secretary of Labor and Substack author.
Welcome to Fast Politics, Robert Reich.
Well, thank you very much, Molly.
It's really great to have you. And I was reading about you before we started podcasting, and you have been in every Democratic administration.
Since Franklin D. Roosevelt. No, actually, we go back to... late 19th century. It starts with Jimmy Carter. Yeah. You know, I said to my students, I was in the Clinton administration, Carter administration, and I was a special assistant to Abraham Lincoln. And they used to laugh at that. They don't laugh at this anymore. And it's starting to worry me, Molly.
But it is interesting. You really have seen the Democratic Party through a number of decades and seen the sort of trajectory. I have this theory, maybe because I'm going to name drop here, but I'm going to name drop someone that no one cares about anymore. When I was growing up, I spent a lot of time with Gore Vidal, and well, not a lot, but a little time with Gore Vidal. And Gore Vidal had this whole theory that America's the United States of amnesia because we remember nothing. We never look back at all. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about kind of how you feel that these Democratic administrations have changed and what your takeaways from that are.
I mean, the big shift happened in the late 1970s, and that was at a time when workers in the United States stopped getting wage increases. I'm talking about most of our workers, people who were paid an hourly wage, people who were at that time, a third of them unionized. But everything came to a fairly grinding halt in the late 1970s. This wasn't the fault of Jimmy Carter, happened to happen on Jimmy Carter's watch. But Ronald Reagan did kind of exploit it and celebrate it. He said government is the problem. And I think from that point on, Democrats were intimidated. They didn't want to go back to the New Deal. They didn't want a strong government to help average working people. And I worked for, well, I campaigned for Walter Mondale in 84, and then I campaigned for Michael Dukakis. You remember these names?
Yes, very much. Yeah.
And then Bill Clinton in 1992. And these people, these men, really adopted the notion, they were called Atari Democrats. They adopted the notion that the Democratic Party really did need to move toward the information economy and the suburban swing vote and the knowledge workers.
Rich people.
Well, who became rich people, but essentially abandoning the blue-collar working class that had been the foundation of the Democratic Party. And we're living with that legacy right now.
Yeah, I think that's really such an interesting and salient point. And I mean, I do feel like Reagan is the original sin on a lot of this. And he sort of took advantage of it. And then this idea of democratic anxiety is so interesting to me, because I do think you cannot live in our political world without being very clear that Democrats are anxious. And you could say it's because of the stakes, but it's also just a different way of operating in the political world versus Republicans.
Well, I think the Democrats did let the American working class go. I mean, they kind of abandoned them. And I saw this happening. I mean, it happened during the 1970s, the 1980s, 1990s. There was a void. I mean, the traditional Republican establishment was big business and Wall Street. So who's there for the working class? Who's there for working Americans? I mean, in effect, Trump filled a void that was already there. Trump exploited the fact that there was a large and an ever more desperate working class had not really got a raise adjusted for inflation since the late 1970s. Most Americans living paycheck to paycheck, no job security, no more pensions. Most people don't really have the advantage of looking forward to a pension. I mean, American workers have got screwed and shafted. You know, in recent years, Democrats are much better, and I think Biden has done a much better job. But a lot of Democrats over the last 30, 40 years have not really given the working class an opportunity to move ahead.
So let's talk about what that would look like. I mean, the ways in which you feel that Biden has been more pro-worker and what you how that could keep going.
Well, I think Biden, unlike Barack Obama and Bill Clinton and Jimmy Carter, really has embraced average working class people and labor unions. And, you know, he's really tried to give workers an opportunity to bring back manufacturing and manufacturing jobs. I mean, all of these investments that have been made under Biden in manufacturing in the Midwest, in many Republican states, they don't know it yet. Maybe they'll never give credit to Joe Biden, but he really has done it. There are all sorts of industries that he has that will generate a lot of jobs and manufacturing jobs and good jobs, particularly if they're unionized.
Do you think this is in some way related to Joe Biden, considering himself to be a working class person?
I think so. Yeah, I think Joe Biden really, you know, born in Scranton, Pennsylvania, grew up in Pennsylvania. That's where I was born, by the way, and Delaware, and, you know, taking the train back and forth. As far as I remember, and I worked around him and with him on various things over the years, he never really took on the mantle that some Democrats did of the kind of fancy modern Washington world. I knew Washington, Molly, when Washington was kind of a seedy town. You know, under Reagan and after Reagan, it became a very rich town. But Biden never really indulged that aspect of Washington. To his credit, I think he stayed a working class person.
Yeah, really, really important point. And I think that's also true. And you do hear when he talks about it, because the fact that his father lost his job and they all had to move, it was one of the things that shaped him in a good way, I think, as a president.
The loss of a job and having to move your family, these were traumatic events for a kid. They're traumatic for a family. Most American workers right now have even less security than Joe Biden's family had when Joe Biden was growing up. And the lack of job security, the fact that in this country you can be fired at any time for no reason, you know, makes American capitalism one of the harshest forms of capitalism on the planet.
Hot take. Even worse is the fact that your health insurance is tied to your job.
Your health insurance is tied to your job. Your pension is tied to your job. Any other benefits that unions have fought for over the years is tied to your job, obviously. But if you lose a job or if you are a part-time worker, and right now, you know, anywhere from 15 to 25% of American workers are working part-time. They are working maybe two or three jobs part-time. They're not, as workers were 30 or 40 years ago, attached to their companies for a lifetime. Well, that means that there is a deeper level of insecurity.
Yeah, I think it's really important point. I think there's more positivity towards unions publicly, but it does seem like we're at a place where rebuilding unions should be high on the list of things that Americans are doing.
Absolutely, because unions fought for higher wages. I mean, in the 50s and 60s, when I was growing up, over a third of Americans' private sector workers were unionized. Now, 6% are in unions. A progressive pro-worker agenda also attacks monopolies. And this is something else that Joe Biden has done. He's had antitrust division of the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission very, very proactive. A pro-worker policy also fights to make sure that big companies are following the dictates of the National Labor Relations Act of 1935. And this is something Joe Biden's labor board is trying to do and is really doing actually more successfully than any labor board has done in 40 years. It gets no publicity, but it just like fighting monopolies, it's exceedingly important.
Didn't they reject the merger with Spirit?
The anti-monopoly crew of the Biden administration was very active in that litigation. And yes, it was important and is important to fight monopolies like, well, aircraft monopolies are a good example.
Yeah. Talk to us about Boeing, because I feel like a great time to just, I mean, I don't know if you saw this, but Secretary Blinken's plane broke and he couldn't get home. It was yet another Boeing. There was some blaming in the billionaire class that this was all caused by diversity and inclusion. So I'm hoping you could talk about that.
Well, it's caused by monopolization.
And corporate greed.
Boeing is the poster child for monopoly. I mean, there's nobody else. Boeing merged with McDonnell Douglas and became a giant monopoly. Nobody has any choice. I mean, if you are an airline and you want to buy an aircraft, what are you going to do? If you go to Europe and try to buy something from one of the major European manufacturers, you've got to wait in line for 10 years. If you need aircraft right now, Boeing is about the only possibility you have. But if you're a monopolist like Boeing, you don't have to worry about your consumers. You don't have to worry about quality. You don't have to worry about anything. Obviously, Boeing is concerned right now because of all of the problems with its MAX, and it's had those problems for years. But that's something else about a monopoly, Molly. I mean, a monopoly has lousy quality because there's no competition.
Right. Let's talk about one of the other things that the Biden administration is doing. Very unsexy, but really disproportionately affects people who have less money and also people who can't do math, aka me. Overdraft fees.
The Biden administration has cracked down on these fees, banking fees, overdraft fees. They're things that if you put your money somewhere and you want to take it out, and it turns out that you have taken out a little bit too much, more than you had, you are charged interest, but the interest can be huge. And the bank, there's really no good regulation on this. If you borrow from a lender on Wall Street who is a local lender, really backed by Wall Street, but a lender that is charging could charge up to 300% on your loans. I mean, you've got these fees. You've got loan sharks out there. The average worker, the average person is very much susceptible to all of this. And so the Biden administration is definitely cracking down.
It is a way to protect people who have less, right?
Yeah. The other thing that needs to be said, Molly, is that the Biden administration, remember, it is facing a Republican wall of regression. Republicans really are standing in for big business and Wall Street, but they are using the rhetoric of anti-establishment populism. So a lot of people are very confused. You know, somebody like Donald Trump comes along and says, I am your voice. I represent you. Yet, what does he do? The only thing he did when he was president was a huge tax cut, mostly for very wealthy people and big corporations. Biden has to deal with a Congress that is very, very difficult. You know, the Republicans now control the House. The Democrats are holding on to the Senate by a very thin margin. It's amazing what Biden was managed to accomplish in his first 2 years, given the intransigence of the Republican Party.
Yeah. One of the things that we don't talk about is corporate America, even if they pretend to care, I mean, they really support the Republican Party.
The corporate America is basically bankrolling Republicans. You know, Davos this week, where you have the biggest American corporations and the CEOs gathering in their annual big confab in Switzerland. The theme this year, if you can believe it, is rebuilding trust. What's really ironic here is that many of the companies and CEOs who are talking about, we worry that about American political instability and how it's going to affect our bottom lines, they are pouring money into American politics. They are supporting the 147 election deniers who are still there.
Right. You know, this is about tax cuts for businesses. I've been trying not to talk about this because I don't think it helps them try to get it done. But there's some pretty exciting legislation that could happen with the child tax credit being brought back. Can you talk about that a little bit?
America did an experiment in 2021. It didn't last very long, but it was an important experiment. We provided every family with children with a certain amount of money that enabled it enabled families to do better and also cut child poverty by almost 50%. And then because the Republicans in the Senate didn't want to continue it and Joe Manchin joined the Republicans, it ended. That experiment ended. Now there is a possibility, once again, for having at least part of that experiment revived with an expanded child tax credit. And hopefully this compromise will go through.
Thank you so much, Robert. I hope you will come back.
I'd be delighted, Molly. Well, thank you for everything you're doing to alert the public with the truth.
Jay Willis is the editor of Balls and Strikes. Welcome back to Fast Politics, Jay.
Brian, thank you for having me. What are we going to talk about today? Is anything going on?
No, nothing. And no legal stuff.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me.
We're going to start by talking about what's happening in the Supreme Court. This season of MAGA Supreme Court chaos was billed as the season where they don't act as crazy. Go.
They are acting just as crazy. There's just, I guess, what's the analogy? Like, yeah, this is still like a prestige drama. It's just that there's like fewer explosions in this one. I think this is like season three of The Americans as opposed to some of the earlier ones.
Right. It's Succession and not Game of Thrones.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Whereas last season was Game of Thrones and the season before. Talk us through this case that they're hearing oral arguments about the Chevron deference.
Right. I will talk through what that is first in the briefest possible fashion to avoid having listeners fall asleep this quick into our conversation. Because overturning this concept, again, Chevron deference, is very critical to the conservative legal movement. So if you hear it and you think that sounds boring, that is pretty much exactly what Neil Gorsuch wants you to decide. So,
right.
Basic schoolhouse rock, right? Congress passes laws, but most of the laws Congress passes are very general. So, for example, the Clean Air Act basically says we should have clean air. But lawmakers aren't saying exactly how to do this. Like, Lauren Boebert doesn't know shit about pollutant parts per million levels. So the laws just say, listen, the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, staffed by experts, staffed by scientists, you figure out the best way for us to have clean air. The EPA creates rules called regulations, basically the same thing. And that's sort of the bread and butter about how laws actually get enforced. Now, sometimes people will challenge these regulations. Like, for example, a petrochemical plant that wants to pump more poison in the air will be upset about its obligations not to do that. And when these challenges come before courts, judges employ what's known as Chevron deference. It's named after a 1984 Supreme Court case. The court looks at a rule and it says, listen, is the law, is it clear or is it ambiguous? And if the court thinks, you know, it's ambiguous and the agency did a reasonable job of figuring out how to go about this, this isn't our lane as a judge. As long as the agency is, you know, not way outside the scope of what seems reasonable, courts defer to the agency. Remember how Lauren Boebert isn't good at pollutant level determinations? Neither is Brett Kavanaugh, right? That's the idea behind Chevron deference.
Right.
Conservatives, you know, they want government so small they can drown it in a bathtub. They hate Chevron deference because, in their view, it gives a lot of power to agencies. Now, a little side note, conservatives didn't always hate Chevron deference because it was very helpful to them during Reagan-era deregulation. Some of its loudest fanboys, two guys named Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas. But once courts started using it to uphold sort of more progressive rules under Democratic administrations, you'll never believe it, but the conservatives changed their tune. So that's what these cases that the court is considering now are about. It's about overturning Chevron and just turning decisions about air pollution and water contamination and medication safety and a billion other things over to unelected life-tenure judges.
So the idea here is that they can just sort of do whatever they want when it comes to the environment, right?
They can. The idea is that they can sort of substitute their own judgment. If they don't agree with a rule, they may say, you know what? I don't think that's a reasonable interpretation of agency power, and force the EPA to sort of go back to the drawing board.
That really is sort of their larger gestalt of trying to limit the power of the federal government.
That's right. And there's not sort of a super clean answer as to what would happen to legal challenges without Chevron. But that's kind of part of the problem, right? This has been sort of a background principle of the law for 1984, 40 years now. The day-to-day work of governing a country of 350 million people is really hard. And undermining agencies' power to do that work would just be like really disruptive and unsettling. Like, I'm not saying that agencies always get their decisions right, but again, I want the FDA to make decisions about food contamination, not Sam Alito, not Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Right. And the idea is that you can then politicize things that should be about science.
That's right. And I mean, we have a Supreme Court that is famously anti-science, a conservative judiciary that is famously skeptical of that kind of thing. That sort of thinking could be tinging like major decisions about policy in this country in the years to come.
So let's talk for a minute about the oral arguments for a second. Justice Kavanaugh is into this.
Your friend and mine.
Yeah. He's just really a dum-dum, right? Not to put too fine a legal point on it.
Yeah, sort of sorry for the legal jargon, right? Like,
yeah, exactly.
Sometimes I struggle to talk about this because I don't agree with Brett Kavanaugh's jurisprudence, ideology, life choices, any of that. But like, I want to sort of separate that from sort of this like really unique role I think he plays on the court. Like, I can't stress enough how much of like just a guy Brett Kavanaugh is. He is like repeatedly sort of the like most obviously in over his head at oral argument when he writes opinions. I just don't think he's very smart. And I mean, this guy was like a Bush administration lackey for years. Like, this is not someone with sort of the academic pedigree to the extent that anyone gives a shit about that, that some of the other justices bring. Like, he's just a dude who was in the right place at the right time. And now he gets to hear the sound of his own voice even more often.
Yeah, one of my favorite things is all the people who are so mad about diversity, equity, and inclusion seem to not understand that their quote-unquote non-diversity hire is as dumb as a box of rocks.
Yeah, he has like a very funny tick where he will latch on to a word or phrase, and you can just tell he's thinking like, man, I've come up with something smart here. Like famously at oral argument in Dobbs, which, you know, the case the conservatives used to overturn Roe v. Wade, he kept returning to this idea that the court could be, and I'm quoting here, scrupulously neutral on the issue of abortion. And he said that a couple times, and I remember listening to it and just being like, oh God, like he thinks he's got this. And sure enough, like he wrote a concurring opinion in Dobbs that was just like littered with references to neutral and neutrality, the court being neutral on the issue of abortion, which like is... Like,
how would that
some of the dumbest
work?
Shit I've ever heard, right? The court's going to hear two more cases this term about abortion. The court can't get out of this issue. It's only making different choices about whose side it comes down on. Yeah, he just very much brings the energy to these of a guy who like just remembered today that he has to deliver a presentation on the book report. And he didn't finish the book, but he did get to skim the spark notes. That's how he does his job as a Supreme Court justice.
Now, Justice Jackson is a bit different. Will you talk to us about that?
Yeah, Justice Jackson got a lot of, I think, well-deserved praise for like really doing her homework in her first couple of years on the court. But this conservative court claims to be the champions of history and tradition. I think that is dumb and wrong and disingenuous for a host of reasons.
Right. Also because they're not.
Yeah, that is principally one of the reasons, yeah, I don't like it. But Justice Jackson tries to play the game, really goes back and brings in famously the history of Reconstruction amendments during the oral argument over affirmative action to correctly make the case that affirmative action policies are in fact consistent with the 14th Amendment and the Reconstruction Amendments. She didn't win that argument, obviously, but shout out to her for at least trying. And I mean, the fact is that, like, you know, a lot of these sort of competing ideologies is, you know, mostly interesting to law professors and legal pundits and no one else. What matters is whether or not you can count to 5 votes. The liberals can't do that, but I respect the liberal justices for trying, for giving it a shot, and for, at the very least, right, like exposing the fact that, as Justice Jackson did in the affirmative action cases, the conservatives aren't real champions of history and tradition. They are champions of the history and tradition, the elements of it, the slivers of it often, that lead to their preferred result.
The Supreme Court is going to look at some Trump, I don't even want to say cases, right? But they are cases. Can you explain to us what they're looking at and how and why?
The biggest case, the most potentially consequential case, is the decisions about Trump's eligibility to run for president again under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. 14th Amendment was passed in the wake of the Civil War, and one of its key provisions is that if you previously engaged in insurrection against the government, we are not going to let you hold political office again. You can't try and overthrow the union and then be like a key part of its lawmaking governing process. At the time, there was sort of one big insurrection that they had in mind, but there have been other insurrections since then.
Now there are new insurrections.
That's right. You may have been familiar. So the Colorado Supreme Court decided that Trump is not eligible under what this, it's called the Disqualification Clause. The Maine Secretary of State made a similar decision, and both states, for now, want to leave Trump off their presidential primary ballots. Trump, as you can imagine, does not much care for this, has challenged it, and the Supreme Court will hear oral argument in the case next month.
One of the things I'm so struck by with Trump, and the reason why Trump is where he is right now, is because at every point, sort of people have said like, oh no, the real rules don't apply to this guy. We have other special rules. Like, it's kind of the definition of white privilege, right? Like, yeah, you know, I know everybody else has to go to jail for doing crimes, but not our guy because he's, you know, he's Donald Trump. And so I do think it's kind of interesting when it comes to 14th Amendment, you have people who are saying, you know, this is not what it's made for. But it's actually, this is exactly what it's made for.
Yeah, I have been both surprised and unsurprised, definitely dismayed by sort of the army of political pundits and like ostensibly smart legal scholars who are just like twisting themselves into rhetorical knots to figure out why this shouldn't exclude a violent insurrectionist like Donald Trump from the ballot. Michael Leeroff wrote a great essay for Balls and Strikes, great website, ballsandstrikes.org, about this. There's sort of this through line in a lot of these op-eds that's basically like, well, the legal process isn't the right way to reject Trump. Americans should reject him through the political process at the ballot
box. Which they did.
That happened. I mean, if you want to get technical about it, outside of the Electoral College, that happened twice. There's also this idea that, you know, we mustn't exclude Trump because if we exclude Trump, his supporters will become violent. And I just sort of question the use of the word become there. They are going to be violent no matter what. You can't, as again, as Michael wrote for the site, like, there aren't really magic words that you can get to stop reactionaries from being reactionaries. And it certainly shouldn't stop you from using the howlingly obvious legal tools at your disposal to prevent dangerous people like that from being in positions of power. It just smacks of, again, as you said, sort of the deep-seated sort of cowardice and tolerance within the pundit community of finding ways not to apply the law to people in ways where they sort of fear the unknown consequences.
Yeah. And I mean, I also think like they're saying, well, it's a political process and that senators should be the ones who vote to convict. And as we remember, senators would absolutely not do that because they were scared for their safety.
Right. Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, Congress enacted that to prevent violent people from assuming positions of power. I don't really understand the pundits' urge to sort of second guess that by requiring additional congressional action, additional Senate confirmation. Like, this is what the law says. And I don't deny it, like, again, as my friend Michael wrote, it's definitely true, right? That like removing a major party presidential candidate from the ballot is like kind of fraught. But you know what else is fraught? A violent insurrection that almost ended with Nancy Pelosi and Mike Pence getting murdered in the Capitol. Like, there have to be consequences for this.
Yeah. It's such an insane moment in American life. And I think we don't spend enough time sort of pulling back and going like, this is not how any of this is supposed to work. The 14th Amendment is, you know, the fire alarm because there is someone who did insurrection, who wants to be in office. And now, you know, we're having an argument about gentility, right? I mean, like, this is not how any of this is supposed to go.
Yeah, like, I get really frustrated with sort of the terminal collegial brain that political pundits, and especially that legal pundits and law professors are infected with, where they will just find a way to say anything nice about, like, people who would deny them civil and human rights. But the idea of looking the other way on a presidential candidate who, you know, thinks immigrants are vermin and wants to round people up and deport them from the country on day one, that's almost a parody of frog in the boiling pot, right? It's a little too on the nose.
Jay, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you again for having me.
And now your moment of fuckery.
Wait, do you want fuckery?
Yeah.
Do you want some dirty hot fuckery?
Yes, you psycho. Yes, I do.
Oh, man.
Poor Jesse. Jesse's like, his life just flashes before him.
Jesse's like, mom and dad are talking weird.
my mom, I'm older than, yes.
That's right. But only by like 6 months.
The fuckery that I have been paying the most attention to this week is frankly the desperate media-driven attempt to make Nikki fetch.
Yes.
Nikki's not going to be fetch, folks. Nikki's not going to be the one. It like borders on insulting to the American people that, as what Tim Miller calls the horse race industrial complex, keeps trying to put the paddles on her. It really bothers me because we are not there anymore. This is not the world we live in. She's done. It's over. And the shock and awe effect that will hit people next week when they say, wait, we thought there was a wait, what? I mean, it's time. And I've had a lot of anger about that because, you know, we're in the moment where the greatest competition between authoritarianism and a limited government republic based on the Constitution, the rule of law, has ever been imagined in this country is about to happen. And a lot of people are going to be surprised, in part because we have seen over and over again that people cast this race not as what it really is, but as a viable Republican primary. And that ain't the case.
My moment of fuckery is going to be you talking with Frank Luntz. Tell me why Frank Luntz is a problem.
I've known Frank for a very, very long time. Before I knew him, my first interaction with Frank, and I got in trouble because I was actually working for the government at the time, was at an event where he was defending Ross Perot, saying, oh, he's not going to take Republican votes away from George Bush.
Yeah, he totally. We love that guy.
I was like, yeah, he will. And what the fuck are you talking about? And I got a little like nasty gram from the White House political office, like, You didn't have to use your real name in that. But Frank is a guy who's believed in this like dream of some sort of third party do-gooder, not Republican or Democrat, just American right. thing. And I kind of had to take him to school on Ali Velshi on Sunday morning, because this isn't a contest between the perfect third party candidate grown in a laboratory somewhere who's going to pursue good technocratic impulses to make America, you know, a safer and healthier country. It's between Orange Hitler and Joe Biden. It's between the darkness for 1,000 fucking years and a guy who has been a center-left Democratic president who's done a pretty good job. The idea that you have some perfect compromise candidate in the middle somewhere is a luxury that American politics cannot afford this year or maybe ever, because we're fighting a smart, evil movement. And when you get somebody who's willing to say this sort of things like, oh, well, you know, people are going to run to a third. Joe Manchin would be such a good. No, stop it. It's insanity.
Yes, exactly. It's insanity. Who is Joe Manchin for? No one. And stop it. No labels will do nothing but make Trump president again.
Which they don't have a path to 270.
Which might be their goal.
Which is their goal. You're right. They're funded by Harlan Crow and the Republican Party. So, you know, call me crazy. All right. Well, thank you as always.
Thank you, fun times. Rick Wilson.
You betcha. I'm your Huckleberry.
That's it for this episode of Fast Politics. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to hear the best minds in politics make sense of all this chaos. If you enjoyed what you've heard, please send it to a friend and keep the conversation going. And again, thanks for listening.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast hosts Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hello, from Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. We've always been intrigued by stories of disappearances, whether it's a fraudster from the 17th century who kept evading the authorities, or a novelist who taunted the Nazis and faked her own death. We all want to know, what happened next? To find out, listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.